Salutations, one and all. Welcome to today's episode of Risk and Reels. I am your host, as always, Jeffrey Wheatman. Today, I am joined, I'm very excited, by Mike Holcomb. Mike and I have known each other, I'm going to say 8 years or so, right? Yeah, somewhere around that, I think.
Yeah, about that.
So Mike has a very complicated title. So Mike is a fellow. He is the ICS OT cyber lead at Fluor, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, one of the largest engineering and construction firms in the world, right?
Yep, that's us.
So we'd be interested to hear a little bit about that. We definitely want to hear about your background. But as everyone knows, first thing, we start off with a movie question. Name a movie that represents or shows or talks about the clash of two different worlds. So whether it's past and present and future, culture, family, or whatever, and why you picked that movie and sort of maybe what lessons you learned, and we'll go from there, and then I'll share mine.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's a great question because you could take it in so many different directions. Yeah, I'm definitely a big sci-fi geek. So if you take that approach, I think of like Stargate, you know, kind of from Worlds Collide, or I also, probably some of my more favorite movies, and this is probably the direction I should go, you typically tend to do around, you know, class. And so my favorite movie of all time is Trainspotting. So I think there's, you know, some of that in there. When you look at Moulin Rouge, I think, you know, I've mentioned on the, I think, comment on LinkedIn for your last podcast that I had listened. You mentioned Big Fish, and I was realizing like all these Ewan McGregor movies that actually, you know, like are in my top 10. And I've never thought of myself actually as a Ewan McGregor fan, but apparently I am.
So here's the interesting thing. I think that the fact that you say you don't think about it shows you how brilliant and talented he is, because you don't really think about it, right? It's funny you mentioned Moulin Rouge, because we saw Rod Stewart in concert last night. He's 79 years old, so he took quite a few breaks for quote-unquote costume changes, but I think he was probably backstage like taking oxygen. But when he went off, he had these backing singers and instrumentalists, these six lovely women, and they actually sang Lady Marmalade from Moulin Rouge. And I got to tell you, that may be, to me, one of the top 10 songs of all time. I hear that song, the hair on my arm stand up. And I'm not typically a pop music guy, but that song was special. So, okay. So you mentioned a couple of movies. Pick one and why.
One we didn't mention, but it probably too much of a giveaway. Let's go with Trainspotting. I used to live in San Diego, and I went down to the little indie theater to watch it. And I remember at the box office, there was a warning sign that said, no refunds given for the movie after the first 10 minutes. I was like, what the heck is going on?
I love that movie. It's super disturbing for those of you that have not seen it, but it's a great movie. And I just think that the casting, Sick Boy, disturbingly, is actually my favorite character, which is probably tells you a lot more about me than we need to know.
He was great. Yeah. They were all great in that movie. The casting was on point.
And
sure.
Think about it, right? It was very early for a lot of them. Right. Very early, like Kelly MacDonald, that was, I think, her first movie. She's turned out to be a terrific actress. We had just recently watched Boardwalk Empire, and she's got a major role in that. The girlfriend, the mistress, the wife, the ex-wife, and the ingenue sort of through the whole thing. So, all right. So that's a great choice. So I'm going to go a slightly different way. And this is actually a genre of movies. I'm going to pick a recent one. So I like the movies where you meet the character and he or she seems like a perfect husband, wife, dad, mom. And then something happens and it turns out that they used to be like a crazy killer for the mob. And that they sort of open up the safe and they got all the guns. So the one I'm going to pick is actually Mr. Nobody, who starred, his name is escaping me. Get the guy for Mr. Show, and he was in Better Call Saul, and yes. So I love that one. I think he's amazing. He went from being a comedian to being actually a serious actor, and I just think he's terrific. And I love Breaking Bad and the prequel Better Call Saul. So, but I just love that movie But there are so many of them, right? There was one with Viggo Mortensen in it, where he was a gangster. John Wick. John Wick is another one that we love. Well, the big joke, and John Wick's actually been my movie choice a couple of times on the podcast, but the big joke is anytime we're sitting and we try to watch a movie, either me or my daughter go, oh, you know, there's this new movie. I don't know if you ever heard of it. I think it's a romance. John Wick. And that's the joke. But I'm also a huge Keanu Reeves fan. So, all right.
I was going to mention The Matrix earlier, but I thought that was a little too obvious. So I held myself back.
So, but that's actually an interesting one, because that's sort of an inadvertent sort of clash of worlds, right? Where he steps into it. I think a lot of the other ones that we're talking about, people make a conscious decision to jump from one world to the other, and then sometimes it catches up with them. But The Matrix, I'll tell you, The Matrix maybe more so than any other movie I've ever seen just blew my mind the first time seeing it in the theaters. Unfortunately, they then followed it up with 2, 3, and 4. All right. So I think that Clash of Worlds is a great sort of topic, I think, to talk about because of your background and what Floor does. And right off the bat, ICS, OT, cyber, right? Those are different things. Historically, OT, IT, ICS was a different thing, a different animal dealt with by different people. And now we're seeing this convergence. So first thing, Mike, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your impressive background and sort of how you got where you are, and then we can kind of talk about some of the trends that you're seeing, that we're hearing about in that sort of convergence. I don't want to call it a clash because that sounds violent, but we can talk about convergence.
It can be sometimes. It can be. But yeah, I got in the cybersecurity world. Actually, I've always been a computer geek, you know, since day one. And I remember watching this kid at school and kind of junior high, and then moving into high school, where he was cracking games to be able to copy them. And he would write cheat codes, right, to get unlimited gold and weapons and such. And I just was really fascinated with the different things that he had done. Now, I was a really good boy, you know, so I would never do anything like that. But I just remember watching. And then at the same time, War Games came out. So it was kind of like that watching, you know, just the hacking process, you know, with, of course, there's always, you know, the girl that's also involved. So when you're 12 years old, I mean, yeah, you definitely naturally gravitate towards that, I think. Security is always something that I had always wanted to do. So once I got into IT, it was a pretty quick transition to full-time security. Security was just always something I did, you know, in IT, and then went through, you know, I worked actually at a company that did IT training and then built out the security program there, and then went to run a security team in financial services. So I had about 30 folks on my team back in the day. I worked at a telecom for a couple years, so I know subnetting like the back of my hand. Really well. That was probably about the best thing that came out of the telecom world, and built out the security operations center there. So I was really proud of that. And then I did consulting for about a year. I was just doing pen testing. Actually, I had a blast doing pen testing that year, and then got a call to go to work at Floor. And I had no idea what Floor was. And I said, okay, I'll go check it out. And didn't realize it was one of the world's largest engineering companies. We also do some construction and some other things in there. At right about the same time is when the Stuxnet incident happened. That was in 2010. So if you're not familiar with Stuxnet, for those listening, that's when the United States and the Israelis, as nation states, they had created malware to essentially infiltrate a uranium enrichment facility in Natanz, Iran. And the whole point was, instead of dropping physical bombs and destroying this facility, using malware to infect the control systems, the industrial control systems or operational technology.
Right. It was the centrifuges, right, that basically imploded.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you can control the computers that control the real things in the world, so they could control the computers that control the centrifuges, and the centrifuges would spin the uranium gas, you know, really quickly to enrich it, so that way they could use it to potentially make nuclear weapons. They would use that to be able to break that down and destroy those centrifuges over time. And so that was really the first known instance or incident of, you know, true industrial control sabotage / cyber attack. And that's where I started thinking, like, well, you know, how does this work in a power plant? And how does this work in, you know, water? And how do, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just happened, you know, to be at Fluor. And of course, the first year or two, I'm just head down, learning the job, you know, getting everything up and running. And then I realized, oh, yeah, you know what? We're an engineering company. We do some of the largest projects in the world, and we probably have some of those control system things around here. And it kind of just took off from there. And really started talking with people and inside the company and out, of course. And there's a great community that's built up around industrial control, cybersecurity out there, which is really impressive. And then just kind of look to where we're at today, you know, working with some of the world's largest companies like Shell and Saudi Aramco and SABIC and others in some of the world's largest control system environments and help build them secure from the ground up.
Yeah, so you made a lot of really good points there, and I love the phrase you use. If you can control the computers that control the technology, you can pretty much do whatever you want. And I think that's a connection that a lot of people don't really think about. And Stuxnet, I think you're right, was a great example. But there's an experiment I saw that actually predated that, and it's, you could probably find the video somewhere, but the DOE, the Department of Energy in the US, probably 40 years ago, made a video where they were able to change the sensors on this huge dynamo generator thing, and they were able to bypass that, and the thing essentially blew up. And people went, "Ooh, that's bad." Yeah. And I think there's so many of those things, right? There was the one, the German steel mill, where the smelter malfunctioned, and they didn't even realize that was an outside-in attack for 3 years or something. Because to your point, no one thought it was a thing.
Exactly. Operation Aurora was highlighted. That was Michael Asante, who's really kind of considered the godfather of industrial control cybersecurity, and using that as to make the point that you can take a few lines of code, which is all it took to make a physical change in the world. And they were trying to, of course, in that case, demonstrate what an adversary could do to your systems.
I want to sort of expand on that a little bit, because, you know, so you mentioned all of the industrial controls, but the other thing that, and I have a little bit of a history with Fluor, I think probably maybe right before you got there, or maybe right around when you arrived, where we were talking about things like, well, you have all this digital content, right? You have building plans, you have pricing models, you have contracts, all of that digital information that is also very valuable, right? There's the one famous story that wasn't even a hack, but some Europeans and some Americans were working on some space project, and somebody was measuring in millimeters and somebody was measuring in inches. And then they went to go connect the two pieces together and they didn't connect, right? Imagine going in and changing the specs of a piece of technology and the cascading failures. Let's talk a little bit about it, and I think you've sort of worked through this, right? For a long time, the security model in the space was very much about security by obscurity. No one knows how these things work. They're not IP enabled. They're not using traditional protocols. So we're good, right?
You're right. That was the idea back in the day, right? There's a lot has changed, though, you know, in especially not only the last 20 or 30 years, but in the last couple, you know, because, you know, there's a couple ways you can look at it. Because, yeah, 30 years ago, when you had a power plant, if there were computers there helping run the plant to generate electricity, yeah, it was isolated. They weren't running TCP/IP. They definitely weren't running Windows. And so if an attacker did get into the environment, they would have no idea what to do. And then now you fast forward, and a big part of that IT-OT convergence is really this concept of, you know, we can manage all these IT environments really easily because we use these Windows systems everywhere. So let's put those in the OT environment to make managing it that much easier. Oh, and by the way, we want to use a common protocol like TCP/IP to connect everything. And, oh, the great thing about TCP/IP is that it connects you to everybody and the internet, which I don't want my power plant connect to the internet, but that can actually happen.
I don't want your power plant connected to the internet.
Right, right, exactly. Exactly. And so that's the big parts with you with IT OT convergence is really the move of, you know, we talk about commodity operating systems, but it's almost always Windows, right? Windows system. So if you look at a power plant, yeah, the power plant has turbines and generators and combustion chambers. And those are controlled by, when we talk about industrial control systems or those computers like PLCs or programmable logic controllers and your HMIs or human management interfaces. So you have a little screen that you can interact with to control that process. And those are all great. Everything else is usually Windows machines. You could even have Active Directory for your OT environment. And we have servers that are set up, not only file servers, but what we call data historians. So kind of when you're going back and you're mentioning data integrity. So data historians record, we call process data, or how the environment functions, right? If I have a power plant, I'm generating electricity. Well, how much electricity did I generate? Right? How is the plant functioning? Right? How much resources like natural gas and water did I use when I created that electricity? Right? So we're bringing all that in for historical purposes, for reporting. And then eventually we could also understand how to build customers. Or if I have a manufacturing facility, right? If I'm manufacturing insulin, I have to be able to how much insulin injections did we manufacture today? So I can get that information to the back office so they can coordinate things like shipping and other logistics. And so all these systems, it's all Windows, it's all TCP/IP. So it makes it very easy now for attackers when they get into environments, right, that they can kind of move from IT over to OT. And that's what we saw almost, 3 years ago now with the Colonial Pipeline breach. And that was really, I think for me, I think a lot of other people saw that as the watershed moment where organizations really started to realize that they needed to start taking cyber seriously. Or if they didn't, they were. Because before Colonial Pipeline, the only attackers you used to be worried about were the nation states. You know, it was Russia, it was China, it was the United States or the Israelis, right? They're coming for you. And a lot of environments, like if I'm a small manufacturing environment, what am I worried about the nation states for, right? And I'm not, right? If I'm a small water treatment facility in the middle of South Carolina, why do I care? I don't, right? I'm not on their radar. But since Colonial Pipeline was when the United States' largest gasoline pipeline went offline for 10 days. And it wasn't a nation state adversary. It was a ransomware group.
Right. And they came. I live in Southern Florida, so my gas prices were directly impacted by that attack because Colonial feeds my whole region. Actually, your region too, where you are.
You go to the gas station. Some gas stations didn't have gas. Now you could go around the corner. There's another gas station with gas, but there was a long line if you weren't there at 3 o'clock in the morning. Right. So that was one thing where there was a real world impact that people saw. So that helped. And then also realizing it wasn't a nation state attacker, right? It was this ransomware group called DarkSide out of Russia, right? I'm a Star Wars fan, so I'll go with it, you know, but you know, they were just sending out phishing emails to everybody in the world, right? They had email addresses for, and they just got somebody to click, right? Infect their system, infected all the IT systems at Colonial Pipeline. And then eventually the pipeline was shut down for whatever reason. You know, I'm sure only the government and the Colonial Pipeline folks really know all the details, right? But at that point, as different industries started to realize they needed to pay a little bit more attention. But of course, the ransom operators and the hacktivists and the other, you know, cyber criminals out there, they realize it as well. And so now you've seen the impact. I mean, there's hundreds of ransomware infections in industrial control or OT environments every quarter. Dragos, which is really the world leader, at least if you live in the Western Hemisphere, you know, they're world leader of industrial control cybersecurity, founded by Rob Lee, who was, you know, the apprentice of Michael Asante, which we mentioned earlier with Operation Aurora, and runs the SANS program as well for industrial control security. But they focus on providing a lot of great educational content, and they have a quarterly report on ransomware and OT that did not exist before 2023. And now you look at where you have, you know, 500-600 incidents just in a quarter, and that the vast majority of those, like 85, almost 90% are target manufacturing. And a lot of, you know, those manufacturing plants, they're not ready for a ransomware attack.
I mean, you mentioned that a lot of these systems are running on Microsoft. And here's the thing. They're not running on the latest version, right? They're running on 3, 4, 5 years ago, and you probably couldn't update the operating system even if you wanted to.
Yeah, depending on the environment, but you're right. I mean, in ICS and in OT world, a lot of times there's this idea, well, it's kind of the, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. So we don't want to patch the servers because everything's running. Right. Well, that's changed, thankfully. So I think people are getting with the times, and they're making sure that they are staying up to date on patches, and they make sure that they have, you know, multiples and of their systems. So that way they have availability in mind. And hey, if I do patch one server and let's say it crashes, that's okay. I have another one, and then I can just rebuild this one that we just crashed and not impact, you know, physical safety, right? We'll make sure everybody on site is safe, the environment in which the site operates is safe, and then, of course, uptime of the facility as well.
So you mentioned an interesting thing that I want to kind of pull on or expand, right? So when we're talking to a bank, right, if a bank gets breached, people lose money, which is bad. But if you have an issue in physical controls, safety, environmental health, people could die. I don't know if you're familiar with Peter Sandman. He's a researcher. He works out of Princeton, New Jersey. So he calls himself a risk communication consultant. I think I probably have spoken about him on the podcast before, but he says risk equals hazard plus outrage, right? And he's using the, yeah, money is a thing, but if people die, it's the front page of the paper. I think there's an education and a cultural thing there too, especially when you're talking to the finance people. You mentioned, you know, the cost of replacing a system. When I was in an advisory role in my previous job where we first met, I used to tell people, look, I cannot in good faith tell you need to go spend $100 million to replace something that works because you can't secure it. And if you go to your business and tell them that, they're not going to be all that jazzed about it. So how do you tell that story? Because let's face it, the work you do probably adds cost to the projects that are being run. How do you sell that when somebody's working on thin margins?
Yeah. It's hard, you know, in different environments and especially smaller, medium-sized shops. So it's not something I come face-to-face with in my day job normally, but I do work with a lot of folks and I get a lot of people contacting me on LinkedIn with questions. You know, for me, it comes down to, our number one priority is always ensuring physical safety, right, of the people on site. Now, there's a lot of people in the industry, a lot of the, especially the old timers that we always talk about, that they don't actually stress that, right? They think it's kind of FUD, right? Or it's that fear, uncertainty, or doubt. And they'll say, well, why waste the money to do anything about it? Because nobody's died yet. So they're waiting for somebody to die before.
That is nightmare fuel right there. No one's died yet.
Exactly. Right. So like, why not be proactive? So there's always the, you know, let's be proactive about making sure people go home at the end of the day. And that, you know, and we've seen different environmental disasters, right? Even the train turning over in Lebanon, right? And the chemical impact to the environment there. Imagine if that was a chemical facility that you lived next door to. And then ultimately, right, we want to focus on those things. But when it comes down to talking about the bottom line, we can always look at operations and uptime, right? The availability of the site, right? If I have a manufacturing plant and that manufacturing plant is down, right, for 10 days, which is about the average time you see, you know, OT environments down in an incident, right? How much money are we losing? And then it's not only just how much money are we losing, but what's the impact to the world around us? Because if that is an insulin manufacturer, there's a significant impact to people with diabetes and or if that power plant goes down for a couple hours, not the end of the world. Power plant goes down for a couple of days or a couple of weeks or a couple of months. That's a whole different story. And so it's not only looking at you know, the responsibility of the entity, right, to make sure that the environments and the people there are safe, but also where we can focus on uptime. The nice thing is when you look at a lot of the security controls that we deploy, like things like network security monitoring, or if you talk about things like SIM, right, to be able to watch across the environment, right? I want it there because I want it from a cybersecurity perspective, and I want to see potential, you know, suspicious events that I can investigate to see, is there an actual incident occurring? Now, 99.99% of the time, when you get an alert and you do an investigation, it's not a hacker in the environment, right? There's no attacker, but it could be an operational issue, right? You could have a problem in the environment that you need to address to make sure that the plant is running optimally, or that even stays up and running. And so that's a really big push. And we get a lot of traction in those types of conversations where it's, yeah, we can deploy these different controls for security, most definitely, and keep people safe and keep the environment safe and keep the plant safe. But ultimately, it also helps us keep not only this site up and running, but we can use it for keeping an eye on all the different aspects of the plant and make sure is it running optimally. And if there's something that's slightly off, let's fix it now before it becomes an issue and brings down the environment. So we do have a lot of success in those conversations.
So I think that's a great sort of nugget there, right? I always sort of articulate it like your executives care about three things: money coming in, money going out. If something bad happens, who gets in trouble, right? But you just gave us a great example of a risk that's real, that's something we should be worried about, but you recognize that selling that to management isn't always going to be as effective as we're down for a week, we're down for 2 weeks or whatever. So I think that's a really, really good takeaway for people to think about. I think we as security, cyber, whatever you want to call us, people have a tendency to focus on the stuff that we know that we think about, which is interesting and kind of, you know, sexy, whatever. But at the end of the day, that business needs to be what we're focusing on. And I think there are lessons to be learned there from the people in finance and the people in facilities and the people in HR. They're talking about business impact, talking about productivity. They're talking about revenue, expenses. And you mentioned earlier reputation, which is always a really tough one to articulate. On a previous episode, I was talking with a buddy of mine, Dave Anderson from Woodruff Sawyer, which is an insurance brokerage. And he was talking about how the security people need to be involved, but their business partners need to support that effort, right? We can't just be security for the sake of security. What do you see as the future of this convergence? Do you think we're going to see more kind of chief security officers that own both sides? Are they can continue to be managed in a silo and rolled up? What do you think?
That's a good question, because I see a lot of different environments. I get to talk to a lot of different people all over the world, and actually just had a CISO for one of the largest control system environments in the United States had called me a couple of weeks ago with a couple of questions. And he is in that role where he is over IT and OT. It's a very new role for him, though. And IT and OT, you know, at least at that point, they're not talking with each other, right? Which is a big problem, right? If they're not talking with each other, nothing really is getting done, right? And so the attackers are only winning. So I like to see probably everything roll up under a CISO, but I think it's just going to probably continue where you see all these different combinations, kind of like in IT, right? We always say, you know, we've been saying for a long time, you're going to have a chief security officer over IT security and physical security. And you see that in some places, but in most, you don't, right? At least I don't. So I think you're still going to see a little bit of everything indefinitely, unless there's regulation changes that potentially one day.
Right. I think that's a great point, because that sort of convergence of physical and IT, I see that ebb and flow in my 25, 30 years in the industry where, hey, let's do this. Oh, let's not. Hey, let's do this. Let's not. So where do you report, Mike, in your organization? So who sits one level above you at Floor?
Yeah. So formally, I report directly to our CISO, and then of course he reports to our CIO who reports to the our CEO. And then I have basically my colleague who is the lead of control systems engineering for Fluor. So he used to head all of control systems and electrical engineering. So he had 4,000 engineers on his team. And then he scaled back a little bit to just focus on control systems for our projects.
One last question, and this we may have to kind of rein it in because it's a very interesting and new topic, right? So the new SEC regulation talking about three things, right? You have to report incidents that result in materiality within 4 days. You have to articulate what the potential risks are on an annual basis in your 10Ks, and you have to be able to articulate what your cyber risk management strategy is. Now, maybe I should know this. Fluor publicly traded?
We are publicly traded, yes.
Yes. And you have a ton of publicly traded customers.
We have a ton of publicly traded customers.
So you are their third party, which is also called out in the regulation. And I don't know if you listened to the hearing, because I did, because there's a lot of stuff wrong with me. But Chair Gensler, at the very beginning, he articulated the third-party risk, and then they didn't really talk about it again. And I spoke with Tony Minnell at our Black Kite, who is our federal person. He said that's a very common thing that they do when they want to get something on the record, but they don't actually want to talk about it in the discussion. Right. So, are you hearing anything from your management about that? Are you hearing it from your customers, either directly or indirectly? Like, because you got to roll that reporting up, and not only what you do, but what they do and what you do for them. So, you guys are in the middle, right? Because you have third parties and you are a third party.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the number of third parties that we have, right? As one of the world's largest engineering construction firms is quite high. So, but yeah, it's one. And I lead the incident response program at Fluor as well. So, you know, that's a big part for, you know, in tying in, you know, reporting requirements, right? And it's a great selling point. I think the company, from executive leadership, you know, down, take it very seriously. And I think that's why I've always appreciated working at Fluor, from the support from our CEOs down and the board, the support they have for cybersecurity. And so making sure that, you know, it's not just talking about, you know, when we say we want to help clients build, you know, not only these incredible environments, but also to build them securely, right? And from a cyber perspective, you know, it's not just fluff. Which I've always appreciated. So yeah, taking all the SEC considerations very seriously. It's already, you know, changed quite a few of our risk processes even since then, in the last probably 4, 5, 6 weeks, you know, where we're stepping those up. There's definitely additional concern, obviously, because of not only the regulations, but any potential impact to Fluor or our clients. The vast majority of time, attackers coming after Fluor, it's not after Fluor data, right? They're coming after the proprietary data of our clients.
Right. So that makes you the equivalent of the bank for Willie Sutton, right? Why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. I think we're going to see a lot of really interesting things roll out as a result. I'm going to float sort of my thought, and then I'll get yours, and then we'll kind of bring it on home. My fear with the new SEC regulation is that companies are going to err on the side of excessive caution, and they're going to put out 8Ks for everything that happens.
Everything. Right.
And there's an example. Microsoft just recently put out an 8K. They had a business email compromise, right? Some of their senior executives their emails were compromised, and they specifically said, this is deemed to be not material, but we just want to let you know. Right? They didn't say that part. Do you think this regulation is going to result in an inability to actually do anything because we're going to be inundated with data?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the way everybody's already seeing it, that it's, you know, you want to cover your bases. You know, if I'm talking with somebody on the legal team, they're probably going to, you know, yeah, we're going to need to go ahead and disclose and make sure we get ahead of this and play by the letter of the law. And then, yeah, the system's going to be flooded, unfortunately, with things that really at the end of the day probably don't matter.
I've actually been thinking a little bit more about it, and we're starting to see a lot of the 10Ks are coming out because it's the beginning of the year. And the one thing that's very interesting is somebody posted an analysis on LinkedIn. He looked at, I think, about 20 of them. About 40% of them actually cited third-party risk, vendor risk, supply chain risk as one of their material risk problems.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, that's the space we play in. And here's the thing. You guys are big. You have leverage. Lots of companies don't. And even you, if you use Google and you call them up and go, you know, I don't think you guys are patching fast enough. They're going to go, thanks for calling, Mike. Click. Right? They're not interested right, exactly. in hearing that. So I made a couple of notes here that I just want to kind of bring back. And then I'm going to hand it off to you for some last minute things. So I think one of the great things you said early on was that if you control the computers that control the stuff, there's a problem. So I love that, right? That's that kind of cascading thing. You mentioned Michael Asante and Operation Aurora. I know the name. I am not familiar with that, but I am actually going to do some research as soon as we're done because this thing is super interesting to me. You talked about Colonial Pipeline, which I think is a great example as sort of a watershed moment is the term you used, and I am inclined to agree because before that, I don't think people realized what the impact was. I think once people's gas prices, and then not too long after that was the Brazilian meat company that had a very similar situation and it caused the price of beef in the U.S. to spike by 40% or something crazy. And then we kind of talked about the SEC thing, and I think that one's gonna play out. So this has been super fun. Any last minute kind of thoughts you want to put out there for the audience?
Yeah, the world needs more security practitioners that are, you know, not only passionate about doing the job, but also in growing the knowledge that it takes to do the job successfully. And that's not easy, right? You have to learn IT cybersecurity, and then you also have to learn about operational technology and how the world works, like from an engineering perspective. So there's a lot of work, but for those that are passionate about it and protecting the world around us, you don't want to be anywhere else. So I do have a lot of resources I make available for helping people get into the field for free. So you can check those out at mikeholcomb.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn and you find the resources. There's a couple of free eBooks to help you kind of 10 steps on how to get on this path. Also have the links to a 20 plus hour free course that I do on YouTube that I put out there as well. So there's a lot of expensive training out there. So so for people that are interested in learning more, you know, those resources are out there. But yeah, feel free to reach out anytime and ask questions, you know, and I'll be here to help.
I want to thank you. I've learned a lot from your stuff. I want to thank you. There's way too much gatekeeping in our industry. I love the fact that you are out there, and I try to sort of make friends with people who want to teach. And I love mentoring people. I love teaching. And I think you need to find a bunch of people from different perspectives, right? Because I can help people understand things. You help people understand things, and then they bring it all together. So with that, I want to thank everyone for joining, and thanks, Mike. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you listen, because we've got some great guests coming up. So with that, stay safe, stay healthy, stay secure. Wheatman out.
Thank you for listening to Risk and Reels, a cybersecurity podcast. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to riveting 30-minute conversation about movies and cybersecurity. Jeffrey will be on the road this year at some of the industry's biggest events, but you can always find him on LinkedIn and Twitter at Jeffrey Wheatman. This podcast is powered by Black Kite, the only security rating service to deliver the highest quality intelligence to help organizations make better risk decisions.